This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Athletic Baseball Show. We are recording on Monday, January 31st, Groundhog Day, just 2 days away, but it may not matter whether or not Punxsutawney Phil sees his shadow if the players or owners have anything to say about this. It seems like spring still very far off. This is the Mailbag Edition. I'm Tim McMaster along with Ken Rosenthal. Ken, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Tim, and you're absolutely right. The lockout continues. It's dragging into its third month. And Evan and I posted a story yesterday, Evan Drellick and I, about just where things stand. And it seemed to me that last week, people were under the impression that there was some movement. And there was. But as this story points out, there are still huge disagreements on any number of issues. And the last line of the story is, the CBA is not close. And it's not close. Now, that said, it can change at any time, and there could be an acceleration of talks, and things can finally progress because obviously spring training is really about 2 weeks away, or the scheduled start of it is. But I don't see that necessarily happening in these next 2 weeks. I don't see any reason for it to happen. I'm sorry, there is reason for it to happen, but I'm talking about the sheer nature of the talks and whether they will begin to finally move in a positive, really positive direction. The sides just don't seem to be ready to go there. And there is not, at this point, a situation where the season is in jeopardy. Now, in a few weeks, come March 1st or so, it could be in jeopardy. It would be in jeopardy. But we're not at an actual deadline point yet. So, we take you through in this article the different issues that are holding this thing up, and it's arbitration, the pre-arb pool, service time manipulation, the competitive balance tax threshold, all of the things that you've heard about before, but there are different positions that each party holds on these particular issues, and that, again, is the problem. So I know these things are not the most exciting reads in the world, but to really understand the issues, I encourage you to take a look at that article, and again, the point of it was to show, point by point, at least on the major issues, why these two sides remain apart and to demonstrate where they are apart. And I hope the article accomplishes that. We certainly worked hard on it. And, well, we will be talking about this, I presume, again next week.
Just a quick follow-up, Ken, before we get to the mailbag, and that is just thinking back to a week ago when there was kind of this positive vibe around all of this, that like steps have been taken. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the steps that were taken were mostly both sides throwing out things that were kind of ridiculous and were never going to be part of this anyway, right? Like they kind of cut out some of the nonsense and at least got to what really needs to be negotiated, but that's not really a very big step, right?
Yes, and that's kind of the point we made, Tim, in the article to some degree, that yes, the one positive thing I thought was the agreement on a pre-arb pool. And what I mean by that is a pool, a bonus pool for players who are in the 0 to 3 year service category, and they would get increases in the minimum salary, which is still being negotiated. And then there would be this pool of bonus money for players who accomplish certain things, whether it's through WAR, wins above replacement, or through actually winning awards. And there is agreement on that framework, that concept. There is not agreement about how much money would be in that pool, and we go into it in the article, the difference is there. So from that perspective, yes, that was progress. The players taking free agency, earlier free agency off the table, yes, that was progress, since that is one of the three things the owners say they won't negotiate. But these are lesser things for the most part. They're not situations or issues that are going to lead quickly to a deal. They're simply kind of roadblocks that are being pushed out of the way, and now they can perhaps negotiate further. But again, I keep repeating myself, they're a long way away from being close, and that is the problem right now.
All right, and with that, let's move on to the mailbag.
Hey, this is Ken.
I'm not available right now. Please leave a voicemail.
If you want to get involved next week, you can call us 646-543-7072. You can also email tabaseballshow@gmail.com. The number of calls has been really down in the offseason. Let's go, people. Pick up that phone. Dial the number. We'd love to hear your voice asking the question so I don't have to read them all. That's my selfish reasoning for that. But we will start with an email, Ken, and this one's from Brian Deal. This is a good mixture of lockout and non-lockout questions. Brian says, hope all is well. With the lockout still ongoing, when do you think a decision would be made as far as starting the season later? Would that result in a totally new schedule for the teams? That sounds like a major headache for those who do the scheduling of the season, and then for each team trying to make travel arrangements. Yikes.
Good point, Brian. No question. And I would expect that to get the season started on time, spring training would need to begin on March 1st. You need a month of spring training. Opening day is March 31st. And if they agreed on, let's say, February 28th, well, yes, spring training could start March 1st. You'd have a crazy spring training. Free agency, trades, arbitration, perhaps all being settled and decided in spring training. But it could happen. So I would say the drop-dead date for the season starting on time would be somewhere in late February. You'd have to have a month of spring training. I don't think there's any question about that. Now, the loss of games is a really interesting question. How would they do that? My assumption is that the league and union simply would agree to pick up the schedule on the date when the season starts. Now, that would lead, yes, to inequities. I'm sure fans would be screaming that, oh my gosh, the Dodgers don't have to play the Giants 23 times. Now they have to play them less, whatever the numbers are. But that would be the unfortunate, one of the many unfortunate outcomes here. And I don't know that we're going to get there. I hope we don't get there. I don't believe we're going to get there. But this lockout has dragged on this long. I don't know that we can make any assumptions in any regard about when it might end.
You mentioned the frenzy of trade, potential trades, and obviously there has to be free agent signings, all of that. So the next question is related to that from Tyson. He's in Iowa City. Tim and Ken, wondering if you expect a lot of trades post-lockout, given that front offices have still been, he says, presumably been able to talk to each other about players. Do you think there are already deals agreed to that can't be announced yet but are just pending physicals, or will us fans be disappointed as maybe front offices will be looking to get more value out of free agents signing short-term deals in a rush to find a new home? Would love to hear any specifics you can share.
Tyson, first off, teams are not supposed to be talking to one another about trades. So that notion you suggested that once the lockout is over, you'll hear a bunch of trades announced like the next day, that should not happen. Now, things happen under the table, we know, in this sport, but that should not happen. They are not supposed to be talking to one another about deals. Now, before the lockout occurred, there was a ton of trade talk, and I would assume in many ways those can be picked up quickly and change quickly or be announced quickly. But it's going to take some more work, and we're looking at two teams primarily that we know are looking to trade, and that's Oakland with really most of their roster in play and Cincinnati with its starting pitching. So yes, those things will happen, but I don't expect them to happen right away. And I don't expect, by the way, a lesser number necessarily of trades just because of this situation that the sport is in. The business that was going to occur still needs to occur. Oakland needs to pair its payroll, or at least is under orders to pair its payroll, it seems. So I expect a similar number of trades and not necessarily a concentration on free agency, but it's going to be the wild, wild west once we get going again, and the wild, wild east and the wild, wild central, and it's going to be quite an interesting time.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. All right, the next question, this one's from Brody, and it actually has to do with players and not the lockout. Thank you, Brody, for bringing us one of these. He says, hey, Ken, do you have a sense on where Seiya Suzuki could end up and how his game will translate to Major League Baseball? As a Red Sox fan, I would love to see him come to Boston.
Well, I don't know where he's going to end up. And Peter Gammons and Pete Abraham of the Boston Globe both speculated on the Giants and Mariners last week, and those are certainly two logical places for any Japanese player, given the compositions of the populations in those cities. But at the same time, there are other teams in the mix, Boston being one of them, and it kind of remains to be seen just how this is all going to play out. His clock for the posting period will resume once the lockout is over. So he'll have, I believe it's 21 days left. I can't recall exactly. Now, what kind of player will he be? That is unclear. Because obviously any player coming from Japan, we never know exactly what he is going to be and what the adjustment will be like for him. When MLB Trade Rumors reported on Suzuki and discussed him as one of its top free agents earlier in the offseason, they basically identified him as an everyday right fielder with power, a guy who could hit 25 home runs. Turns 28 in August, hit 38 homers last year in Japan. So he is someone clearly with pop. But as Andrew Baggerly wrote in The Athletic in his great profile of Suzuki about 2 weeks ago, there is some concern that a shortened spring training could affect how he transitions to the major league game. A Japanese player coming over for the first time might need the full 6 weeks, or probably would prefer the full 6 weeks, rushing to get ready in a four-week spring training or something like that. So that could be a factor here. And it's going to be something to watch because it's going to increase the degree of difficulty for him if spring training is shortened.
It's a great point because he's not just going to be getting used to baseball here in Major League Baseball, but also getting used to life here, right? And
yes,
these guys, it's a big change, you know, language and how to order food and living and all that stuff. And so obviously certain Major League teams have more experience with getting those players ready. You wonder if that maybe impacts him too. You mentioned Seattle. That is interesting. All right, next question. This one's from Zach. He says, hey, Ken, hope you're well. This question is probably a moot point now that it appears the owners and players have agreed on their service time issues and getting players paid earlier with their bonus pool idea. Well, we talked about how they've agreed on some of that. Either way, I wanted to ask about the idea of an extra arbitration year for players after 2 years of service. I've seen a lot of people who think this is the perfect solution. However, my thought is that this would create a huge issue with middle-class players getting non-tendered by years 3 and 4. Just look at Schwarber, Rosario recently. Wouldn't that extra year where contracts can get that extra couple million dollars boost lead teams to non-tendering players, thus defeating the point of paying the mid-tier players earlier? What do you think?
Zach, excellent thoughts. And I have some of the same questions myself. Let's assume that the union gets what it wants here and gets arbitration eligibility down from 3 years to 2. Now, the owners don't want to do that. I don't expect that the owners are going to do that, but this is the union's goal, one of their goals, and it's something that they have not given up on. If that happens, yes, two-year players will get more money. They will no longer be restricted to the minimum salary or something that is slightly above that. The problem is, as you identify, teams are going to be very judicious in how they treat these players, these new arbitration eligible players. They're not going to offer contracts to all of them. And yes, some will be non-tendered. Some will enter into the open market, as we've seen happen with players like the ones you mentioned, Schwarber and Rosario, who are more experienced in recent years. The one thing we know is that if the owners have to pay more to one group, they're going to pay less to another. And they're going to find their way to keep costs down as effectively as they can in their minds. And I do think it's possible they flood the market to a degree with free agents and non-tender players to that effect. The Union, when I've asked about this kind of thing in the past, not specific to the two-year players, but in general, I've basically been told you guys write this all the time and the number of non-tenders doesn't really fluctuate all that much. If a two-year player is valuable to a team, he's not going to be making that much money, that a team is going to non-tender him. Fair enough. I do expect that to be the case to a degree. But I also know that, again, if one group gets more, then another group is going to suffer and owners are going to find ways to just keep those costs down. That's what they do. Players try to get as much money as possible. Owners try to pay them as little as possible. We're kind of seeing the results of that right now in the lockout.
Yeah, that is why we have. That's why we're in this situation. Okay, next question. This one comes from Todd. He is a disgruntled Pirates fan. He says, there's a lot of those. He says, love the show. Wanted to see if there's any indication that Bob Nutting may be looking to sell the Pirates, therefore fulfilling the dreams of many of Buck Nation. In light of the recent sale of the Nutting family's resort properties in Western Pennsylvania, to my knowledge, these resorts constituted the majority of the Nutting's portfolio outside of the Pirates, but I haven't seen much about what that means for his involvement with the team.
I don't know the answer to this question. I'm not inside Bob Nutting's head, obviously, but I don't expect that one thing has anything to do with the other. Now, yes, they did sell three ski resorts in Pennsylvania for $125 million, the family did. But at the same time, and I credit the Pittsburgh newspapers for this information, recently the Nutting property, Ogden Newspapers, bought another media company, and from that, obviously, they are not retrenching, they're adding. So I have not gotten any indication that the Nuttings are looking to sell the Pirates. Clearly, I know Pirates fans, many of them, maybe even most of them, maybe even all of them, would like such a thing to occur. The only thing I will say that may offer some glimmer of hope is that with a new CBA, you would hope that teams feel more comfortable about where the finances of the game are. This is generally what happens, and maybe are more willing to be out there in the markets, trade, free agency, whatever, more aggressively because they know what the structure is going to be economically for the next 5 years. It hasn't obviously changed things for the Pirates the last 5 years necessarily, but that would be something that fans, I think, of all teams can certainly look forward to once owners have that financial security, or at least not that financial security, I should say it that way. The security that there is going to be labor peace and the clear framework of a deal, then they know, okay, we're good, we can go spend. That historically is what has happened.
The Pirates are not the only fan base that is, you know, disgruntled towards the ownership, but would you say, Ken, it's safe to say that they're the most disgruntled currently of all the fan bases?
I think that is fair to say, Tim. Okay. I'm trying to think here.
Yeah, I was too, and I was like, I can't even think of anybody close. But and like, if you
Cleveland, Cleveland is up there.
Okay. Yeah,
but they have a new ownership coming in, or at least a minority owner coming in, and I don't know that the antipathy there is quite what it is in Pittsburgh toward ownership.
Yeah, just because Cleveland has had the consistent success on
Oakland,
the field,
certainly too. Yeah. I should mention Oakland.
Oh, good point. That's that you may have picked a winner with Oakland. Yeah, at least Pittsburgh's not threatening to move the team. So that may be Oakland and Pittsburgh, though, up there for sure. All right, couple more questions here. Jason Reinhardt says, hey, Ken, with no baseball in sight, I've been watching old games from the 80s and 90s. Oh, bless you, Jason. Even then, games lasted 3 hours, but you never heard people complain about baseball being too long or too slow back then. The ball was in play because men were on base, runners moved around via sacrifice bunts, hitting the ball the opposite way for singles, stolen bases, etc. Why did the little things, like I mentioned, get frowned and penalized in stats if it worked back then to win and kept the game full of action? Why have analytics departments not created or adjusted stat formulas to accept these approaches to the game in a positive way? If the game is about outscoring your opponent and getting enough wins to make the playoffs, shouldn't all those approaches to hitting be accepted?
Jason, I love your question. And analytics has had a direct impact on this because it has led players to try to perform in a way that would reward them based on the analytics, because That is how teams are judging players now. So, you hit a lot of home runs, you get rewarded. If you move a runner over, you don't necessarily get rewarded, right? Now, granted, a home run hitter is always going to be more valuable than a hitter who just moves runners over and hits for, I don't know, a modest average. But you talk to baseball people at every level, and I mean every level, and they will tell you the subtle arts in this sport are being lost. They're not being valued by teams who look at velocity for pitchers, right, and power for hitters. And with all that going on, players are like, well, that's how I'm going to get paid. That's what I'm going to do to succeed. It's a very natural reaction. Now, I'll give you a little story from this weekend. I was down in Nashville, Tennessee, speaking at Lipscomb University's baseball banquet. And I was asked by the athletic director, actually. There's an audience of, I don't know, 200 or 300 people. And the athletic director asked me a question in front of everybody. He said, what would you advise young players to do to be the best that they can be? And I said, I would advise them to learn the game and learn how to play the game and master some of the nuances that are getting lost. With that, the head coach, Jeff Forehand, kind of yelled from wherever he was sitting, hear, hear. And again, he's a college coach. But you talk to minor league coaches, you talk to scouts, you talk to high school coaches, everybody. The emphasis on power, on the velocity for the pitchers and the power with the hitters, it's changed everything. And it has led to the art of this game getting lost. It's a problem and it needs to be addressed. And I'm not quite sure how to do it. It's almost like the horse is out of the barn. But I think you hit the nail on the head, Jason. It's something that we all miss, some of the subtleties in the sport that now kind of get lost in the three true outcome era.
Yeah, and I think the problem is that those stats do, you know, the advanced metrics and those sort of things do sway the game the other way. It seems like, Ken, what's going to have to happen, right, is rule changes, which is something that, you know, Theo Epstein last year did a little, I don't want to call it a media tour, but he spoke a few times about the potential things that could happen. He talked to Jason Stark and Doug about that. The little rule changes, you know, whether it's making the bases bigger or the little things that they're going to try, whether or not they get rid of the shift. But it's going to take an actual change to the game to get these skills back in the game. Is that fair to say?
I agree, Tim. And I go back to our Hall of Fame show and Jimmy Rollins. Remember when we talked to Jimmy Rollins and he spoke about positioning defensively on cutoffs and relays, and he spoke about the way they would play balls off the left field wall in Philadelphia and all of these little things that came into play. These are things in general, not always, but a lot of these skills are not rewarded analytically. Therefore, again, they're not valuable to players because players see teams rewarding them for basically analytically driven skills. So I don't know how this all changes. Yes, rule changes would certainly help. But at the same time, there somehow has to be a re-emphasis on the beauty of this sport and doing things correctly and holding a runner at first base. All kinds of things that go on. I can list 100, right? That needs to be revived somehow.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager. All right, we got one more question, and it is a voicemail.
Hi, Ken. This is Thomas I'm from Albany, New York. My question is in relation to MLB.TV and its current blackout rules. As a Red Sox fan who lives in Albany, I'm unable to watch the Red Sox anytime they play the Yankees, not including the playoffs. I was wondering if the current labor negotiations could have any effect on the blackout rules as they currently stand. I know many people across the nation, especially in the Midwest, where there are teams that are, you can have 5 to 8 teams blacked out in a given city or area, really struggle, and it really must hurt the game on a larger level.
Thomas, this is a complaint and a question many fans have, and it's something that has been a source of frustration for the league as well. And you might say, well, if the league wants to fix it, just fix it. Stop the blackouts. Well, it's not that easy. And Evan Drellick wrote an article about this some time ago. I encourage you to Google it and read that article, because he really explained in great detail the problem. And it's a complex problem. And it involves not the players and owners per se. It's not something that can be resolved in a collective bargaining negotiation. It involves the regional broadcasters, the distributors, and the individual clubs. And I'm not going to go through exactly how the process works, but that's where this has to be addressed. Now, in this cord-cutting era, when people are turning away from traditional cable and going to streaming, baseball is hoping to address this. They've been public about that. The commissioner has spoken about this, how he knows it's a problem. Ideally, they want the most fans seeing the most games. That's something that would benefit the sport. And the current situation where too many fans are blacked out for whatever reason is not healthy. But again, I would encourage you to read Evan's article about this, because it does explain why blackouts exist. It is not something, again, that is negotiated through collective bargaining. It has nothing to do with the players and owners' particular issues. What it has to do with are the issues with the broadcasters, the regional sports networks, the distributors, and the clubs, and how that dynamic all works, and whether certain RSNs are available in certain places and whether they're available on certain distributors. It's a big, big, complicated equation.
Yeah, in a perfect world, MLB.TV would get you everything, but we're not there. That story, by the way, August 31st of last year, if you want to check out Evan's story on The Athletic. It is really good. It explains all of this, and you understand after you read it why it is as complicated as it is, because it feels like it shouldn't be. All right, that's it for the questions this week. If you want to get involved next time around, you know the number, 646-543-7072, or you can email us, tabaseballshow@gmail.com. Keep coming back to The Athletic Baseball Show all week long. Derek Van Riper, Eno Saris, and Britt Giroli are now part of this feed. That is exciting. They're still looking for a show name as well, so you can help them out. Send them a tweet if you have any thoughts on their name. Their next episode will drop on Thursday, then DVR and Keith Law will be back on Friday. Keith's top 100 prospects dropped today on The Athletic. Yes, actual baseball talk. So check that one out as well. If you haven't gotten your fill of Hall of Fame content, Ken's Hall of Fame special is packed with incredible guests. Ken Griffey Jr., Jimmy Rollins, Dustin Pedroia, Jim Cott, Jim Palmer, Eduardo Perez, Braden Halliday, Jay Jaffe, Jason Stark, Britt, and Dan Connolly. It was an amazing show. 3 hours. It's broken up into 3 episodes on this feed. You can check it out or go to YouTube. If you search for Ken's Hall of Fame special, you'll find it there in its entirety. And finally, if you want to save 33% off a subscription to The Athletic, go to theathletic.com/baseballshow. Ken, great job with the answers. Have a great week.
You too, Tim. Thank you.
And same to everybody out there. We'll talk to you again soon.